Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear oral arguments from petitioner in St. John v. Pope.
May it please the court, Mr. James Spank, to the argument of the petitioner,
May it please the court, my name is Jim Eubank, and I represent Dr. Holland St. John in this particular action. It's a medical malpractice case in which the trial court granted a motion for summary judgment for Dr. St. John on the basis that no physician-patient relationship had been established as a matter of law by the affidavits on file. Dr. St. John was an on-call physician who made a determination after receiving a call from an emergency room physician that he was not qualified to handle the call and that the patient's problem, the plaintiff's problem, was outside his specialty and suggested that he seek care elsewhere.
Fill us in a little bit on what the record shows as the nature of his on-call contract or his duties and how he related to the other doctors that were also on-call at this hospital?
The nature of the record in that regard, Your Honor, is stated in Dr. St. John's affidavit. Dr. St. John, in his affidavit, pointed out that he was the on-call physician. He is an internal medicine specialist at the Central Texas Medical Center. And that's fairly much the extent of the determination. He does state on several occasions in his affidavit that he had no agreement, he had no contract with the patient, and we believe that's the critical question in this particular matter. There is no controverting affidavit. There's no indication from the other side, from the plaintiffs, as to any contract or relationship that Dr. St. John had with the hospital, nor what any other physicians had with the hospital. Dr. St. John merely pointed out that he was on call. He received the call, and his medical judgment, he was not qualified to handle this. He determined that based upon the history that he received from the emergency room physician, that the patient was suffering from a neurosurgical or neurological problem because he had just received back surgery and or epidural injections and had a fever. Dr. St. John, as an internist, felt like that this was a neurosurgical problem, that Central Texas Medical Center did not have the facilities to handle a neurosurgical or neurological problem, and that he should be transferred to a facility that did. That is basically the extent of the conversations that Dr. St. John had with the emergency room physician.
Do you concede that this meningitis would have been within the competence of an internal medicine man?
Using the retrospectoscope, yes, I do.
Now, if the opposing expert says that the actual ailment that Mr. Pope had was within his expertise, does that not raise a question of fact about a doctor who says, this is not within my expertise because of my diagnosis of what the condition is, as opposed to another doctor said, if he had diagnosed it correctly, he would have determined that it was within his competence to treat that. Does that make a difference?
No, Your Honor, none whatsoever. The key is whether or not there was a patient-physician relationship that would then result in that duty to make a correct determination and make a correct diagnosis.
So
in this case, we never got that far.
So even if the determination, not to enter into a physician-patient relationship is based upon a failure to properly diagnose, that's okay.
Yes, because he never took the opportunity to diagnose. He never got to the diagnosis stage. In fact, in the Fott versus Souls case, there was a call from an emergency room physician.
Isn't it a diagnosis to say this is a neurological problem?
No, that was his impression. That was his impression based on the limited information he received from the emergency room physician.
Speaking.
And he simply said, it sounds to me because he just had
a statement of symptoms. Observations of emergency room physician, and he came to a conclusion or rendered a medical opinion based on that's not a diagnosis. And to refer them, did he refer them to a specific facility?
No, he did not. He simply said that we don't have the facilities at Central Texas Medical Center to handle these problems, and you need to take him. He needs to be sent either to the doctor who just did the surgery, or to a facility that can handle his problem. And we've got
just any facility, but not this one.
Well, one that has appropriate facilities. I believe that's the exact words that Dr. St. John had in his affidavit.
Refer them to a specific.
He did not.
And his sole contact with the patient was a telephone call.
That's it. That is exactly it. And well, he never talked to the patient. It was solely with the emergency room physician. And that's where we believe that the Court of Appeals was incorrect, and they assumed that merely taking the call from the emergency room physician generates a duty to a person in the plaintiff's position. That is a novel theory in Texas law that, in fact, has been rejected on many occasions. A physician's duty is limited in the medical negligence concept to that he is not liable for medical negligence unless he has a physician-patient relationship. And there is no general duty simply because the concepts are based upon contract, either an implied or an express contract with the patient. A patient goes to a doctor and says, please treat me. The doctor has the right to say no or yes. If the doctor says yes, then there is a contractual obligation that he has.
Now, this is certainly true when it comes to a stranger walking into a physician's office or something like that. But what about the hospital relationship? This person was admitted to the emergency room, I presume, at the hospital. And you have an on-call physician who has a contract with the hospital that I presume requires them to serve in an on-call status periodically.
There is no summary judgment.
It's a little beyond the stranger's meeting in the street or in the doctor's office situation, isn't it?
To some degree it is. But even in the context of an on-call physician, the courts have been unanimous in holding that unless there is a physician-patient relationship, there is no duty to an individual who is in the emergency room. Even in the emergency situation, even when a physician is probably qualified and probably could make the diagnosis. In the Fott versus Soles case.
The problem I have here is that he made a diagnosis, so whether you want to call it that or not. But he expressed an opinion based upon the symptoms that were related to it. Even though it wasn't a personal examination of the patient, he rendered a diagnosis. That is not within my purview. That is a neurological problem. We don't deal with that. And then you have expert testimony on the other side that says, hey, I'm in the same business he is. I do the same thing he does. And the standard in the community says if you get this kind of symptoms, that indicates some type of infection situation. And it's clearly within our province and our purview of our competence.
Dr. Levine had the benefit of reviewing medical records many months afterwards. He had the benefit of the retrospectoscope, as I mentioned. All that Dr. St. John had was a simple telephone conversation that lasted a very short period of time and did not make a diagnosis. He did not say this person has a neurosurgical problem. He did not say this person has meningitis. What he said was, it sounds to me like he has a neurosurgical or neurological problem because he just had back surgery and you need to send him on to someplace that can help him. I can't help him. And when he did that, he said, I decline to enter into the physician-patient relationship. I decline to enter into that contract, which is the basis for medical negligence. The statute, 4590I, makes it extremely clear that a medical malpractice suit can only be brought by patients, implying that there is this relationship. In the Salas versus Gamboa case, the Act implicitly recognizes that the physician-patient relationship must exist before a cause of action may be claimed. Throughout the definitions in the malpractice statute, 4590I, it refers to a health care liability claim resulting from a patient. So the question is this a particular patient of Dr. St. John? And the answer there is unequivocally no. When I look at all the factors that most of the cases look at to determine whether there is a relationship, all of them were negated by Dr. St. John. He was not a prior patient.
Does it make a difference that this is an emergency situation and would there be some higher duty in that instance?
No, because the two cases, Your Honor, that I rely upon heavily in the brief, one of them was the Fott case where a man came in with a compound fracture of his leg. The emergency room doctor called an orthopedic surgeon who said, looks to me like you got a bad problem there and it's more than I can handle and he needs to be transferred to a trauma unit. And the court held that there was no physician-patient relationship even though that doctor was on call, received a telephone call, and it was an emergency situation. The Childs versus Wise situation was even greater than that. It was a woman who came into the emergency room in active labor, about to go into active labor. The nurse called an OBGYN within his specialty and said, this woman is going to have some problems. And the doctor said, I don't think that I can handle it. It's going to be too soon. She needs to go see her own doctor. She needs to get to a hospital in Dallas. Then court held that there was no physician-patient relationship even in that emergency room situation. So I don't think that it makes a difference. It's all purely on the basis of whether a contract exists. It would have been a surprise to Mr. Hope if he had received a bill from Dr. St. John from that telephone conversation. He certainly did not bill him for that. He established no contractual relationship whatsoever. He did not order a test. He did not make a determination as to an examination. He did not prescribe any treatment. He did not make any recommendations other than you need to get him to someone who can help his problem, which I think is a good thing for and should be encouraged for a doctor or a physician to do. Even if they ultimately end up being wrong, I think a doctor needs the flexibility and the ability to take a call, make an analysis as to whether or not they are qualified to render the best treatment possible for the patient, and if they decide that they can't do that, then to send them on their way to somebody that can. Nothing that Dr. St. John did was in fact wrong, per se. He suggested that he get to a better facility. That is not something that would be considered to be inappropriate. Now, the case law has been extremely clear time after time as to whether there is a mandate for a physician-patient relationship in order for there to be negligence, medical negligence, to arise. In the Byrd versus WCW case by the Supreme Court in January, they cite four Court of Appeals opinions for this proposition. In the Vineyard case, the court declined to find a legal duty because there was no physician-patient relationship. Wilson, a physician is liable for malpractice or negligence only when there is a physician-patient relationship. Holding a physician liable for negligence, etc. And the courts go on and make it very clear that there is no general duty of negligence, which is exactly what the Court of Appeals held. Court of Appeals made two mistakes. First, they held that there was a general duty to the public at large for physicians, as per the Otis Engineering versus Clark case. And secondly, and they said that this duty is irrespective as to whether or not there is any physician-patient relationship. That simply is not true, and it's been unanimously held in Texas that that simply isn't true if you want to bring a medical malpractice lawsuit. Secondly, the mistake that they made is they determined that by undertaking to identify Mr. Pope's condition, by asking the questions of the ER physician, what's wrong with him, what does he complain of, what is his history, the Court of Appeals held that by undertaking to do that, the doctor assumed a legal duty even without a physician-patient relationship. And it's our position that the mere undertaking does not establish a doctor-physician relationship. In fact, the public policy of the state of Texas is to encourage doctors to ask questions to determine whether they are the proper consult, whether they are the proper specialty, and whether they, in fact, have the best facilities locally to handle that particular patient.
Mr. Eubank, the folks rely heavily on Gifford and Wheeler cases. Would you speak to those cases to why those cases are distinguishable from the facts in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Wheeler, and what was the other one?
Daugherty versus Gifford and Wheeler versus Getty Kirsten.
Okay. The Wheeler versus Getty Kirsten case very specifically distinguishes itself in the body of the opinion. It said, unlike the situation in Fought or Child, Dr. Rodriguez was not asked nor did he refuse to come in to examine the patient. Instead, he was asked to evaluate certain information and make a medical decision. In that case, the doctor was on call. They called him and he said, okay, here's what you should do. You should send this patient to John Seeley Hospital and you should get him in an ambulance and you should do it right now. He actually undertook and did give medical advice as opposed to the situation we have here where Dr. St. John, in fact, said, no, I can't handle this patient, and no, I'm not going to come in and treat.
If Dr. St. John says go to Breckenridge Hospital, I know they have a large emergency room, then he may be liable. If he just says, no, you know, do your best, drive around Central Texas till you find somebody, if you can't find your own doctor, then he's not liable.
That's the catch-22 that I think we're trying to avoid by getting the court to agree with our position. We're trying to encourage...
Well, then Yeti Kirsten must be wrong. I mean, if this doctor said our hospital doesn't have the facilities, But X Hospital does, and that's liability.
In the Yeti-Kirsten case, the doctor gave advice to the nurse, which eventually was followed by the nurse. And according to the Yeti-Kirsten opinion, that's exactly what distinguishes it from the Fott versus Sulz and the Childs case, where the doctor said, look, I'm not coming in, and I'm not going to treat that patient. You need, and in that case...
This, I mean, the rule that you provide for us would encourage doctors to not try to help people get proper care.
I would hope not. I would hope that, in fact, if doctors understand, if the court gives a clear opinion that doctors can legitimately screen cases to determine if they are best qualified, if they say that there is no general duty, if they say that there must be a physician-patient relationship before you can incur liability, it will encourage doctors to take consultations and encourage them to give professional responses to professional inquiries, and will encourage them to tell the doctor at the emergency room, look, you need to do something about this patient, and you need to do something quick. I simply can't do it.
But to maximize your non-liability, you should let the patient be on his or her own.
That would be something,
no need arguing about it.
But that would be something that I would hate to see happen, is where a doctor, and that's what we're trying to avoid, is where a doctor feels like he can't say, he can't even take the call because of potential liability.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear arguments from respondents.
May it please the court, the respondent.
And please the court. I think it's important to keep this case in its proper context. This is a summary judgment case. As a consequence, all inferences must be drawn in favor of the Popes, all doubts resolved in favor of the Popes, and all evidence presented by the Popes accepted as true. Second, when the summary judgment was issued, the operative pleadings, plaintiff's pleadings, pled general negligence. That's all, that the defendant was negligent. No special exceptions were filed by the defendant prior to the hearing. What that means as a legal matter is that any fact issue that gives rise to any type of duty is a basis for holding Dr. St. John liable. Third, the sole basis advanced by the defendant for summary judgment was that because Dr. St. John did not diagnose, care for, or treat Mr. Pope, there was no physician-patient relationship and thus no duty. And that is the sole basis for the trial court's granting of the summary judgment, that there was no physician-patient relationship. So that Dr. St. John cannot prevail on any other basis. The only way he can prevail is if, one, it is legally impossible for a doctor to owe any type of duty outside the physician-patient relationship, because that's all he moved for, and that's all he got. And if that's true, two, if he negated every basis for a physician-patient relationship. And the simple fact in this case is he didn't meet either. He doesn't meet either test as a matter of law. Even the Texas Medical Association, in its amicus brief that it filed with this court, admits that outside a physician-patient relationship, a doctor can owe a duty for medical care rendered. And that's the series of cases that it cites where doctors who perform independent medical evaluations, example, the Texas Rehabilitation Commission, or for an insurance company in a contested workers' compensation claim, owes a duty. Not to affirmatively injure is the duty, but it's a duty. So as a matter of law, they lose this case because they didn't negate every possible duty that was owed. It's very simple. They said you can't owe a duty unless there's a physician-patient relationship. Even the Texas Medical Association admits you can owe a duty outside a physician-patient relationship. They didn't meet their burden of proof because they didn't negate all possible duties given a general negligence pleading. Yes,
Mr. Schechter, I wanted to ask whether your argument would extend by analogy to the attorney client relationship. Hypothetically, if a person walks into a general practitioner's office, a person who does mainly real estate and wills and things like that, and they call perhaps a board-certified specialist in the area that they suspect this may pertain to, and asks for some advice, you know, what should I do with this person that's walked into my office? And perhaps the general practitioner seeks to refer the patient to this specialist, but they decline the referral, and something bad happens, perhaps limitations runs or something like that to the client of the general practitioner or whoever's client it happens to be. How is that different from this case, and is there liability to the specialist and the attorney-client situation?
No liability to the referring attorney, obviously, and I don't know whether there was a contractual relationship between, no liability to the attorney
Let me make this very clear.
We are not contending that if Mr. Pope walked into Dr. Suarez's office on Main Street in San Marcos, and Dr. Suarez said, you know, I think you have a heart problem. I'm going to call St. John over here. And he calls St. John, and St. John says, you know, I'm just too busy right now. You need to get another intern. We're not contending that creates liability. This is a unique case in that it arises out of the emergency room of a hospital. And the undisputed summary judgment evidence from Dr. Pope, from Dr. St. John's own mouth, is that as on-call physician, he owed certain responsibilities. Okay? He admits that in both of his affidavits. Now, what responsibilities he owed changed depending on how he needed to posture himself. But he admitted he owed responsibilities. And what we believe is that in a summary judgment setting, that is an that creates an inference that he had a relationship with that hospital. He himself felt he owed obligations to people who came to that hospital. They may have been limited or narrow obligations, but he himself said, I owe those minimal obligations. The more accurate analogy for a lawyer situation, if you will, is if you give me a retainer. You say, Schechter, here's $10,000. You represent the following 100 people if they call and they have criminal problems. I say, great, I'm ecstatic, I put the money. You say, it's non-refundable, take it, go away. Go hence and represent everyone. I get a phone call and I say, nah, go get a divorce lawyer. It's a guy down at the criminal courthouse. And I hang up on him, one of your people who has called me. I owe a duty. I cut a deal. I accepted responsibility, and that's what we're saying Dr. St. John has not negated.
Well, presumably Dr. St. John had a contract or an agreement with the hospital.
But he himself felt he owed certain obligations because he said that twice in his affidavit.
And the question is whether that's whether Mr. Pope is a beneficiary of that, sort of a third-party beneficiary.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And in this setting, the question is different. The question is, did they negate that as a matter of law?
Let me ask you, Mr. Checker, I know that's what you're focusing on, but it seems to me there are certain facts in this case that are undisputed, or at least the facts around which this case revolves. An emergency, is there summary judgment evidence in the record that creates a fact issue as to whether or not an emergency room physician must treat every patient that presents him or herself to a hospital in an emergency situation?
An on-call physician, you mean?
An on-call physician. Is there a summary judgment, disputed evidence? Is that issue even raised here that an on-call physician has a duty to treat every person that presents themselves to an emergency room?
That issue is not raised.
Is the only issue that is disputed in this circumstance is the issue of whether or not the meningitis was within the specialty of Dr. St. John?
That is one of the issues raised. The other is, Your Honor, whether there are facts in this case that gave rise to Dr. St. John's duty to take some action. In other words, I do not quarrel that if a guy came in with his leg broken and hanging out on his right at 90 degrees, I don't think Dr. St. John had a duty to come. But Dr. St. John did have a duty to follow the steps that he says he was obligated to follow in his affidavit, which is to assess the condition, to analyze what's happening, and to make a decision about what to do.
Is it your position that, or is it your position that a doctor can never discuss a patient's condition, come to the conclusion that they are not qualified to treat that condition without having accepted a duty to the patient for which they could be liable if they're mistaken as to their competence to handle that condition?
And are we now talking about the exact facts as here where you're on call and you admit that you have the following obligation? See, that's I think, the key here is this man says in his affidavit, you know, I had a duty to obtain a thorough history. I had to determine if it was within my specialty to treat that patient. And then he adds in his second affidavit, which isn't in his first, to determine if the hospital has adequate facilities to treat it. But he had a duty. This is what he says. This was my obligation. And that's, I think, a distinguishing factor between this case and the other cases cited by Dr. St. John. Is he set out, this is his obligation. That was his relationship with the hospital.
So if I understand it, your position is that those two factors, the fact that he was on call and the fact that he testified to some degree, raise questions about whether there's a duty in this case. If either of those were missing, then you think there would not be a duty in the case.
Your Honor, and I think you have hit on the distinction between this case and Fought versus Soul. And if you read Fought versus Soul, it's on page 220, it notes that Soul was under no contractual obligation to be on call, nor was he required to be on call to maintain staff privileges. Now, Dr. St. John contends, well, that wasn't negated. So I went down to the Harris County Courthouse and I got Dr. Soltz's motion for summary judgment because I just had a feeling that wasn't true. And in paragraph one of his motion for summary judgment, he notes that he's relying on the pleadings on file, his deposition testimony, his affidavit, and the bylaws of Eastway General Hospital. On page two, he notes that he was on call. But the fact that he was on call, however, did not obligate Dr. Soltz to accept the patient pursuant to Eastway's bylaws. And then on page 7, he says, nowhere in the procedural guidelines for Eastway General was an on-call physician required to admit all patients. He was free to decide whether he would admit a particular patient. He was only required to consult with the emergency room physician. He could then elect whether to admit them. And then there's Dr. Soltz's affidavit, which says, we're not required to accept each and every patient who presented the emergency room. So he had a different set of facts that Dr. Soltz's lawyer created, or that the summary judgment evidence created. And I'd be happy to provide the court the motion for summary judgment and Dr. Soltz's attached affidavit.
You can file a supplemental brief if you desire to do so.
But those things, it seems to me, are at least it's inherently a fact inquiry into whether there's a physician-patient relationship. And what distinguishes this case from Childs and Fought is that the fact inquiry indicates that this particular physician agreed to take certain minimal steps, and when he breached those minimal steps, and I didn't just offer the affidavit of anybody, I mean, I offered the guy who teaches people how to do this at the Baylor College of Medicine, board certified in three different areas, and he said, you know, he was wrong. He made a mistake. Doesn't make him a bad person.
So the conversation between Dr. Suarez and St. John had been in the cafeteria during the break. as opposed to a telephone, the result would be different.
Maybe not. Depends on whether he was the on-call guy. Let's suppose he wasn't the on-call guy. Okay? Let's suppose that St. John just happens to be walking through and Dr. Suarez comes into the cafeteria and says, I've got this troubling patient here. No duty. I'm not seeking to impose a duty in those circumstances. This is a very limited set of circumstances. It's fact-specific, and that's what I think the court should focus on. And again, it's key to remember that the duty in this case to negate every possible fact that could give rise to a duty rests right here. We don't have to do anything.
So in these circumstances, you're asking the court to write an opinion that says, in these type of unique facts, there is no need for a doctor-patient relationship in order for liability to arise.
Or the court could hold
that. Is that what you're asking us to write?
Or the court could hold. There are various ways the court could get to what I think. The Court of Appeals, I think, reached the proper result. To be quite candid, I don't expect this court to reach that result for the same reasons. But I think there are several ways the court can get to that result. One is to say that in this limited set of facts where you have a relationship, you have a duty. The other is to say
but not a physician-patient duty. It's analogous to one of these other non-physician
patients. Or you could say that the relationship with the hospital creates a physician-patient duty to take certain steps. It's not a full physician-patient duty. But it's a physician-patient duty, perhaps, or you may say it's a full physician-patient duty, but at a minimum, it's a physician-patient duty, and I tried to write down the things that I thought minimally, a physician should have to do. At a minimum, he should have to ascertain whether he has the proper qualifications to treat a patient. And if he does, he's got a duty to go down there and look at the patient and see what's going on. Second, at a minimum, he has a duty to obtain a thorough history from the ER doctor so that the doctor, he or she, can evaluate the nature of the patient's illness. And if it requires prompt treatment, they need to go treat. And finally, if they're going to give advice in those circumstances, in this unique set of circumstances, it better be the right advice. They've just got a duty to make the right diagnosis. That means they've got to get enough information in so that they can make the right referral, if that's what's happening, or the
if
right...
If this goes back, the record does not seem to be absolutely fully developed here.
And I think that's an understatement.
If we were to affirm the Court of Appeals on a somewhat narrower ground, it went back and this hospital center has something, some paragraph in there that they don't have to take every patient. They can make a decision, right, wrong, no reason. Apart from, of course, the anti-dumping statute. But I don't think that's being alleged here.
No, Your Honor.
Then you might still lose at directed verdict stage.
I might still lose, but I'm pretty confident, based on things that have transpired since, that I'm not going to lose at directed verdict stage or summary judgment stage at the court.
But, I mean, all the hospitals have to do under these circumstances is give that emergency room physician give the on-call physician the right to refuse a patient for any legal reason. And then this duty evaporates, does it not?
It may well, Your Honor.
Is there any summary judgment proof that this hospital would have, it's really a question better placed, but that this hospital would have not taken this patient, but for Dr. St. John's determination that they couldn't do the treatment properly?
There is no summary judgment evidence that this hospital physically did not have the facilities to treat someone with meningitis.
But is there any summary judgment proof that there was any other? Well, I'll ask you.
Director, let me ask you, understanding in the affidavit of Dr. St. John, you're saying he had a duty to make an assessment of the qualifications. It seems to me critical to Dr. Levine's affidavit, I guess I'm pronouncing that correctly, from Houston, that a test, an invasive test of the patient had to have been done to have determined the existence of meningitis. Does the duty of an on-call physician go to the conducting invasive test,
before they had satisfied their obligation to make an initial assessment as to whether it's within their competence.
The way I interpret what Dr. Levine said is that given the facts, the high white blood cell count that indicated a raging infection, the fact that this man had recently had what was an epidural steroid injection involving injection right around the spinal cord, the fact that he was, as reflected in the hospital records, delirious, he had to be restrained, he had a high fever, he had the classic symptoms of meningitis. And that what I interpret Dr. Levine's affidavit to say is that Dr. St. John should have known as an internist, as a medical student, but certainly as a board-certified internist, which he claims to be, that this was a potential problem, that it's an emergency situation. You don't have time to mess around with this or you're going to leave somebody permanently impaired, and that he had the duty in that case to get over there, and that if either of these fellows, the emergency room doctor or Dr. St. John, had done the lumbar puncture, they would have diagnosed the situation. Now, I think what Dr. Levine
lumbar is... Lumbar puncture, is that a spinal tap?
That is a spinal tap.
Now, that's a pretty invasive proceeding, isn't it?
It is an invasive proceeding, but it may be that he wouldn't have had... In other words, it may be he could have satisfied his duty by going over there and seeing the patient. Maybe it would be his diagnosis that, given different situations, maybe he would say the patient didn't need this. Maybe the guy just has a stomachache or whatever, in a different set of facts. But I think that if the doctor properly discharges their duty and they go over and there's an emergency situation that is within their field of expertise and they're on call with these duties, that once they go over and see the situation, they've got a responsibility to act.
In developing the common law, don't we need to be very careful not to set up a general rule, even though it may operate fairly in one country, that's going to encourage people to do more than they're competent to do?
I believe that what is the phrase that Justice Holmes used to judges hand down decisions from molar to molecule? You're dealing with them very interstitially in very small spaces, and that's why I think that if you focus on the facts of this case, and I think this
we may not write on hospital emergency room duties for six more years, if we set up a duty that refusing to admit a patient can lead to liability, that would be the caption on this case. Isn't that likely to be a duty that may cause more harm than good across the entire state?
I'm not in a position to... you have to admit everybody who comes. Is that what you're asking me?
Well, if that's your rules of this hospital, that as you say, you think you're going to be able to prove it if they don't have any
refusal point. I think what they have to do is treat the people who come there within their area of specialty, and at a minimum, they've got to stabilize them so that they can be referred somewhere else for treatment. They shouldn't just be able to send them home to drive around Central Texas.
That's the problem that I keep coming back to. Is there a duty outside the doctor-patient relationship having to do with the emergency nature of the problem?
Your Honor, and I think that's what I'm trying to say, Justice Spector, is that based on the facts of this case...
Well, someone comes in the emergency room having a heart attack. And do they have any duty, as you suggested, to stabilize or to take any action until a specialist comes in?
Yes, I believe that the emergency room physician in a hospital, absolutely has a duty to do the best within that physician's standard of care to take appropriate steps for that patient. And I would think that part of that duty would involve contacting physicians who are specialized in a given area.
And that is within the doctor-patient relationship?
That is within the doctor-patient relationship of the emergency room doctor. Yes, Your Honor. But then you get a different question about what happens when you call a physician which is really kind of the issue we're doing here. But I do not mean to at all attempt to cut off the emergency room doctor's obligation.
And that case is still pending in this?
That case is still pending, yes, Your Honor, in Travis County.
Are there seven defendants and a remaining case below?
There are currently
page five of the petitioner's application, there lists seven remaining defendants. Do you
There's currently Dr. Wilson, Dr. Suarez, there is
Dr. Smalling.
Dr. Smalling.
Round Rock Hospital.
Round Rock Hospital is no longer a party.
Independent Practice Association.
No longer a party.
And it's settled? Just
no, summary judgment.
And Texas Medical Center, Inc. and Central Texas, Central Texas Medical Center, Inc. and the Medical Center.
One of them is a party and one of them is the improper name of the medical center. And so, but that case is a separate case. Don't ask me how this happened, but the judge transferred one hospital to San Marcos, to Hays County. So they're actually, this case is now operating in three different places on three different levels.
So Mr. Pope is not without a remedy. He's got at least two or three viable, alive, solvent deep pockets that he can get remedy from.
Well, I don't know if deep pockets or solvent or I would hope that wouldn't make any difference in the court's outcome.
Sometimes the court creates duties when there is no remedy, and there's a remedy here.
I would hope that the court would create duties where the law and justice requires it, whether there's a remedy or not. The justice.
And in some instances, the court creates duties where there is no remedy to remedy a wrong. And that's a fact.
There are theoretical, I mean, there are still, the case is still alive.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Eubank, is there a difference between an on-call physician and the emergency room physician? We've talked about Dr. Suarez, who was the emergency room doctor, but, I mean, is there some significance to being on-call as opposed to being a doctor in the emergency room, or does that play any role in this case?
It does, Your Honor, especially in the context of the summary judgment record in this case. Dr. Suarez was an employee of the hospital and was there and was obligated to treat. There is no summary judgment evidence that Dr. St. John, as an on-call physician, was required to treat anybody that came or any call that he got from any emergency room physician employed at the hospital. And so there is a significant difference between a doctor who is the treating physician, which Dr. Suarez was, and the on-call physician who receives a call and chooses, declines respectfully, not to come in and treat the patient.
Now, how do you square what you're saying with what Mr. Schechter says about Dr. St. John's affidavit, where he accepts a duty to do a thorough examination and make a determination as to whether or not this ailment is within the specialty of the doctor?
That was an absolute mischaracterization of what Dr. St. John had in his affidavit. What Dr. St. John said in his affidavit is it is clear that there was no agreement, either express or implied, to create a relationship. Nonetheless, an on-call physician who is presented with a patient should, such as Mr. Pope, should, upon receipt of a telephone call, obtain a history, thorough history from the ER physician, determine if he has the qualifications, and determine if the hospital had adequate facilities to treat it. Basically, what he testified to as an affidavit was, I've got to screen this. I've got to listen to the man. I've got to listen and see if I have the qualifications. That's all he said.
But if there's summary judgment proof that he did what he said he had to do and he did it wrong, why doesn't that make this summary judgment improper?
There was no controverting evidence as to whether or not he obtained a history from the emergency room. I mean, that's uncontroverted. Right. There is no controverting evidence that he determined if he had the qualifications that were necessary. That's within his own discretion, his own medical judgment. I think that the on-call physician, and I think this is clearly established in medical history, that an on-call physician is entitled and obligated to use his own best judgment as to whether he is entitled and whether he is qualified to treat a patient, as opposed to some contract which is not in the summary judgment record, which would never be a mandate for an on-call physician to come in. It doesn't happen that way.
So that is not a justiciable fact. a determination by a doctor or a lawyer or a plumber or anybody else, this is a task I can do or a task I can't do, is not justiciable. And the physician makes that determination, and you can't sue that physician or the hospital who's hired that physician to be on call.
You cannot, because there is no evidence that he was obligated to respond to Dr. Suarez's call.
You say there is a duty to obtain a thorough history.
He needs to listen to the doctor to see if he can help the patient.
Obtain a thorough history. Is there a fact question as to whether this history was thorough? Was it adequate?
I think that has to be determined on the face of the record itself. Only Dr. St. John has evidence as to what the history from Dr. Suarez was. And he recites exactly what Dr. Suarez told him, and that is that the man had a fever and had a prior back injury, a back surgery, and or epidural injections. And that was enough from Dr. St. John to determine he wasn't qualified.
If the expert says fever indicates presence of infection.
There is no question that every expert witness looking in retrospect of every case can find something wrong that some doctor did. And that's exactly what Dr. Levine did. This has to determine what is in the subjective mind of Dr. St. John when he receives the call. He has to have the flexibility to use his own medical judgment.
The experts say that the presence of a fever would indicate further inquiry, additional history.
He actually goes further and he says indication of fever, and he lists about 10 other things which Dr. St. John did not have and was not available when Dr. Suarez called. And so
But made no further inquiry. Did not pursue, in response to these indicators, any additional information.
No. There was no indication that Dr. Ford had called back with anything else.
Obtaining a thorough history does not include a duty to take the next step in inquiry?
No, I think a thorough history means that you listen to what the ER physician says.
Take whatever information is available to you, you don't ask for more.
Well, he got whatever information was available, and that was it. And that's all the sermon judgment record said.
Any other questions? Thank you, John. That concludes the oral argument in this call. The following is the preceding two causes are submitted on brief and oral argument. The marshal will now adjourn the court.
Okay.